history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be told, and we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so the rest of us never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we make that quest, as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our veterans. And you know, usually we're talking to members of the World War II generation. Recently, I told you about an event coming up on April 28th to give Vietnam veterans the welcome home they never got. And the Korean War veterans are saying, what about us? The forgotten war is forgotten again, but not today. We're talking to a Korean War veteran in Albuquerque, New Mexico, John Smetana, 87 years old. Been in Albuquerque a long time, but you grew up in Gary, Indiana, more than a line in a musical, huh?
Correct. Very much so. The Michael Jackson Five, yeah. They're from Gary, Indiana.
Well, and what was your childhood like growing up in Gary, Indiana? Were you dreaming of being a pro ball player or something?
Yeah, well, I figured I could be, I was pretty good. I figured I'd like to go ahead and do that, of course, and growing up, but I wanted to play ball, so I had to come to Albuquerque because my parents were thinking about building or buying a trailer park, and this was 1946, and here you had to have a eligibility of 1 year living here before you could play sports. So I came out early with my oldest brother who was in the Air Force, and he was stationed at Kirtland Air Force Base. And I lived with his wife's parents on Roma Avenue here in Albuquerque so I could play ball in high school, which I played basketball, football, and baseball.
Well, and I'm sure before that, when you were still in Gary, you had to have a favorite ball player, right? There had to be someone in the major leagues or a football or basketball star who you looked up to and wanted to emulate.
Joe Cool for the Chicago White Sox played first base. I like that myself. I use a junk pitcher. I'm left-handed. I was a junk pitcher, and I like to throw that way. Very fortunately, I got to see quite a few good guys. Luke Appling, Tony Cuccinello, Cass Michaels, Joe Cool, Taffy Wright. Those are all White Sox guys. Jimmy Dykes was the manager. And an interesting story, Orville Grove, one of the guys on the team, was shot in the foot dove hunting. And my dad knew him. So I got to go down to the dugout at Kaminsky Park, meet all the White Sox, and boy, that was a real dream. So from that time on, I want to try to make the pros.
Well, and there's something else that was happening during those years, and I'm used to talking about it because I spent a lot of time with World War II vets. You weren't in the service yet, but you lived through that time. For those of us who weren't alive during World War II, even for a teenager who wasn't old enough to serve, how big of a jolt or a life changer were those years?
That was very interesting because my oldest brother was in the Air Force, and Pearl Harbor in 1941, I was in junior high. I'll never forget Mrs. Griffith, our history teacher, used to bring the paper every day and read to us about what was going on in the Pacific and all the different battles. And I used to read about the corpsman and the guy from Iwo Jima when they were raising the flag. One of the guys was a corpsman, and in my work as I was growing up, they told me in the Marines, well, you could be a corpsman because of your background. So that was my MOS, which is the title they give to your job. And so that was my introduction to the war.
Yeah, so World War II is over. You move up to Albuquerque here. You're playing sports, probably thinking maybe you will get a shot at pro ball someday. But then the Korean War comes along. You heard you were going to get drafted?
Yeah, I heard we were going to get drafted from a friend of mine down at the draft office. So a bunch of us figured, well, let's join up. Well, I joined the Navy, wanted to go see the world. And I happened to be working in a mortuary at the time while I was going to school. The guy down at the Marine Corps office said, oh, boy, you'd make a good medic. I said, really? He said, yeah, you're used to bodies and hurt people and stuff and taking care of them. I said, yeah, I guess so. And I let it go at that. Well, after boot camp, they had it on my record. And sure enough, they sent us to Bainbridge, Maryland, to the Corps School. And that was interesting. That was after my first 2 years in the Navy. And that's where I learned my medical background as a combat corpsman.
And did you know what you were getting into?
Not at the time, until they said a whole bunch of my friends and I, there was 53 of us. They said, well, you're going to go to Korea. So Korea, well, over there, that police action that's going on, we didn't know much about it at all. And they said, yeah, well, they needed us bad. So they flew us. Most of the time you went with your company on the ship. Well, but they needed us badly. So they flew us over. We went to Hawaii, Guam, and Kyoto, Japan, where we got all our gear. Then they flew us into Korea above Seoul. From that time on, that's where we were, all 53 of us. And they spread us out all over the country, all with different units in the Marine Corps. And I happened to be with the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, 1st Marine Division.
Yeah, and you spent almost 2 years over there, and we're going to hear some of those stories. But something you said struck me there, because you said you weren't really sure what was going on over in Korea, this little police action. And today, well, North Korea has been in the news a little bit recently with Trump talking to Kim Jong-un and all that. But most people today don't know what the Korean War was all about and what happened there. Do you ever run into people who say, what was the Korean War?
People don't even realize or remember it. It's amazing what they don't know about it. And when I went there in 1951 and 52, 53 in January, there was only one building that was 3 floors high, and that was one of our first command posts that we went to, and that was right outside of Seoul. And now it's like a metropolis, these tremendous big buildings and stuff. And now with North Korea talking about how they are, I hope that the president, Mr. Trump, can get together with Un and talk things over, because I think that would be a big stride toward peace. We need it.
Well, and North Korean civilians could sure use it, because they've had a real dreadful existence for many decades here. South Korea's flourished because of your guys' sacrifice and what you did all those years ago. But I'm sure there had to be a moment for you getting over there that was the welcome to the war zone moment. What was that?
I'm glad you asked that, because when we got there, they put us on a train, and we went up north of Seoul, and then we transferred to trucks, and they motorized us up to the front line. The main line of resistance was the 38th parallel, a little bit north of it. And it was amazing that when I did get there in the morning and woke up, and I asked the sergeant after we got out, I said, well, where is this front line? Where is this MLR? He said, you just look right up that valley in front of you, about 75 yards away. He said, that's it right there. He said, so you're in Korea right now. And I was very shocked, along with all the other guys. And just to put the two things in there about the people, the North Koreans at that time, they're pretty nice. You could talk to them and everything else. But the Chinese were the rougher ones, we always felt, at their armor and stuff that they used.
Can you paint a picture of the kind of scenarios you were faced with, how close you were to the artillery that's flying around, the bullets that were flying, grenades, bombs, all of those things? I mean, it sounds like you were right there in the middle of all of it.
How about 500 yards? Imagine 3 or 4 football fields, and we had a command post. When I first got there and started meeting people and some of the officers, we had what they called a command post. And that's where I set up my little medical department. And sure enough, while I was sitting there, only 3 days there, we get shelled by mortars very heavily and got 4 guys killed right in front of me. And a couple guys with a broken back, which we tied up with military cable, electronic cable, and made them a bed and wrapped them up in that and got them out to the helicopters. And I thought, well, this is war. And actually, this is police action, according to back home. And there I was, and I said, well, we're right here, right out in front of us, they're all there. And you could see their trench lines just as easy as ours, and that's how it all started.
Most of us haven't been in a situation like that. You had never been in a situation like that. Is there anything that can prepare you for that? Is there anything that keeps you from being paralyzed with fear and worry that you're not going to make it home and see your family ever again?
You always think of that, and the Marines were great. They took care of me really well. I had a lot of friends and learned my job well, and over there we could get to use it very well. I'll tell you the truth, you're a little bit scared, but you learn what you're doing. and your Marine Corps buddies help you out. And we had great officers, and they wouldn't put you in harm's way. And we used to go on a lot of patrols because there's only three corpsmen per platoon, which was quite a few guys. And so we'd have like 20, 30 guys to take care of. You spend 5 days on a line, and you go back for a rest, and go back for 5 days on a line, and go back for another rest. But as corpsmen, we did a lot of patrols at night. And if the Marine Corps took 9 people out, a corpsman was always with them. So we did the same thing as the Marines did and looked after each other. And I had a few experiences out there, a few wounded, got them back to the lines. Thank goodness they made it. And yeah, it was a different experience. It sure was.
And when you say that you guys as corpsmen did the same thing the Marines did, what you're saying is your life was in every bit as much danger as theirs were.
That's exactly right. I carried an M30, the little carbine, had a 45 caliber pistol, wore that on my hip. But I was strong enough and big enough, I didn't have to carry a stretcher. And when we go on patrol, I felt just like one of the Marines, because if you got attacked or if they did a surprise on you, you'd better be ready to fight them. And we were ready just as they were. And we got along very well. And they really protected corpsmen. The medics to them were life. And so they really took care of us. They knew where we were all the time. And they're a good bunch of guys.
And maybe this is hard to quantify if you spent almost 2 years there, but how frequent was that occurrence of you actually having to treat someone who was wounded, of try to patch him up, try to make sure he doesn't lose his life?
The question like that would be when we were on an outpost, because that's where they really got hit. And when we were on Outpost Vegas, they hit us with everything they had for like 2 full days. And then they came in for hand-to-hand combat. And they are a bunch of wild people. And I said before, the Chinese were actually more wild than the North Koreans. Yeah, you didn't know what to expect. They came up in waves. Some guys didn't even have guns. They'd pick them up when their buddies got shot, screaming, bugles, all that kind of stuff. You hear about it. And that's the way it was. So the outpost is where you got hit a lot. When you were on patrol, you were one-on-one. You didn't really stir trouble. But on an outpost, when you're out there protecting your area and they start bombing you with mortars and big artillery and stuff, it's pretty hard to duck.
Yeah, and it's, I would imagine, a pretty helpless feeling. What do you do in those moments? What goes through your mind?
Well, you try to know where everybody is. You have your own trench line on the outpost. It's circular on top. You have all your communications, and you have your trench line, which is about shoulder deep, and you had little called spider holes. As you go along the trench line, you had little places where you could hide and look and see where they were. No smoking, because they could see those cigarettes. It'd get you good. And when they did attack, you had to be ready. And the Marines were very organized. They were always ready. Took a few days to get Outpost Vegas back, but we did, fortunately. And they were called the Gambling Cities, Reno, Vegas, and Carson. That was a very big battle. And we all worked well together.
But a lot of guys lost their lives, and a lot more were wounded. How long did that fight for that position take, and how many Marines lost their lives?
During that time, when we were on Vegas, it was March 26, 1953. Palm Sunday was that Sunday. This happened on a Thursday night. So we were there Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Palm Sunday, and Monday, April 1st, April Fool's Day. So we had 44 killed, 19 were captured and taken to North Korean prisons, and we had only eight wounded that we could send back that were survivors. The rest were killed. It was kind of a bad day, but we did win it back, but it took 5 days to get it back with a lot of help and a lot of other Marines to replace who we lost.
Well, so many things come to mind for me here. Maybe let's start here. You mentioned those Marines who were killed, that you were only able to save a fraction of the number compared to those who were killed. How hard was that? Just knowing what your job was, to see guys who you couldn't help, who you couldn't save, who you knew their parents were getting a telegram saying they're not coming home.
Yeah, it was pretty sad, really. I was fortunate enough to treat quite a few, save a few, and of course we lost some too. And we always felt terrible about their parents getting the word that they're not coming home. But the Marines were taught that there was Semper Fi, you know, they were going to be always faithful to each other, and no man was left behind. When things got rough, they got rougher. And we thought about that a lot, and we knew a lot of the guys, felt sorry for their parents and their loved ones, and we did what we had to do, and fortunately, we did save some, a lot. And we had the retired Korean Army guys, like, were 45, 50 years old. They used to do a lot of hauling of stretchers and helping us with the wounded, taking them back to the line, which, as I said before, was like 400, 500 yards. And we were out there in the middle of no man's land, but they were right there to help us. And they saved a lot of people, as well as our helicopters and medical staff.
And when I ask you about those who died, I'm also cognizant of what you said earlier, that you would make patrols with these guys. You were right there with them. So I'm guessing there were some guys who were killed who you had gotten to know, who you had counted on, who maybe had protected you before.
That's exactly right. It's a kind of a funny thing that you bring that up, Paul, because we were on patrol one night, and I had this kid in front of me who I knew rather well. I won't use any names, but we crossed a little stream, and when we were on the other side of the stream, there was a tremendous rainfall, and we were coming back after 2 or 3 hours. We came to the same place to cross where we had sandbags placed, and he was in front of me, and he almost drowned. He was a short guy, but a great guy. So I just reached down and grabbed him by the collar and pulled him up. And it's kind of funny. I said, what are you trying to be, a duck floating in the water like that? Well, we did get hit later, and this big Native American guy was with me. I won't mention any names again, but he got hit from a tripwire across the path. And he mangled his foot real bad. So I just said, well, I don't have a stretcher, but I'll bet I can carry you. So I put him on my back, and sure enough, like a fireman's carry, we got back to our lines, and fortunately he didn't lose his foot. Had a lot of mangled bones, but it was always very, very happy to save somebody's life and get him going.
Of course, the reality was you couldn't save everyone, and we're going to hear about one such case when we come back. How our guest, John Smetana, had the privilege decades after the Korean War of helping one family understand what had happened to a brave Marine who paid the ultimate price for our freedom. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Next week, we're going to dive back into the World War II generation, but today we're hearing from a Purple Heart recipient from the Korean War, John Smetana of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Later on in life, he would work on nose cones for the space shuttle project, but in 1953, he found himself in some of the fiercest and bloodiest fighting of the entire Korean War. A Navy corpsman, his job was to treat the wounded among the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment, 1st Marine Division, in combat like the infamous Battle for Outpost Vegas along the main line of resistance at the end of March in 1953. John, I imagine probably then more than ever, you had to be prepared to deal with men whose wounds you could do very little for, that you felt you couldn't do enough for, those brave Marines whose families would become Gold Star families.
One thing about it, you never got real personable with the other people. I mean, you knew who they were, but you didn't get that feeling like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? You try to do the best you can, try to save as many as you can, and you knew you're going to lose some in that kind of a battle, but you did what you could, and you just asked God to take care of them and watch over them. That's all you could do.
And when you described that fight for Outpost Vegas, losing it, regaining it, guys killed, guys captured, were you afraid you were going to get killed in that situation?
Yeah, you were crazy if you didn't think you could get it, because there was stuff flying all over the place, shrapnel and everything, and you have to expect it. And being a corpsman, there was a lot of times you didn't have time to even think about it. You just taking care of guys getting hurt, getting wounded, and doing the best you could to get them back. And they were very good. They were very watchful over us. And I had plenty of good gear and did what we could and got them back for medical help if they needed more. And that happened quite a bit.
Yeah, and can you give us a sense, maybe a few examples without getting too gruesome, of the nature of the injuries you were able to treat, or how you even decided, can we help this guy or not, and move on to the guy who you can help?
I guess what I'd have to say there is, you know that if you get hit in the chest or near the lungs, you have a terrible time breathing. And all you can do out there in the field is put compression wounds onto bandages and hope to fill the gap so they can breathe, at least breathe, and get them back as soon as you can with the chiggy bears and on their stretchers, and get a helicopter to pick them up. But most of the guys that were hit with shrapnel in other areas, like their arms, legs, lower body, you could put on bandages and tie them up real good and put them down together with some other guys, and then call in the help to come and get them out at like a train, like a stretcher train. And I've seen them 15, 20 deep where they were lined up waiting to go back. Yeah, you couldn't really help some of them. Some of them had to either make it or not make it, and that was up to the wound. But you could only do so much. In other words, you couldn't give them plasma out there in the field. You couldn't do things like you can in the hospital, except for the shrapnel wounds that you could see and know where they were. But if a guy was hit hard and critical, you did what you could, made sure that you filled out their emergency tags, and if you gave them morphine and what time and all that kind of thing. But you knew that you were going to lose some and you're going to save some. And so you just had to balance it out and try to save more than you lost.
Clearly, you were always rendering medical aid, but did you ever feel the need to try to deliver some emotional or mental or psychological aid or comfort to these guys whose bodies have just been torn up?
Yeah, being a medic, we did a lot of talking to the guys and kept their spirits up. But of course, they're taught that in the Marine Corps, in boot camp, in their training, that they knew what they were getting into and what to expect. And of course, when it happens, it's kind of a different story. But yes, I talked to quite a few of them, and a few of them I became very close to. I was saying before, I had still, after all these years, which is coming up 65. I've got three or four guys that I still write every year and send Christmas cards and talk about all the stuff we used to go through. And fortunately, they're okay now. I've lost quite a few friends that I knew for a while and felt sorry for them and their families. And that's about all you could do.
Those are guys that you treated in the field?
Yes, there's two or three that I treated, and there's quite a few fellow corpsmen that have become like professional people, captains in the state police, all kinds of things like that. One of my friends did that. Another friend played some baseball. He's in New York now. But yeah, we write every year, talk to one another. But the only Marines, there's about three of them, and two are from New York. One is from Milwaukee, and one from Flint, Michigan, that I keep in touch with. And they have families, and thank goodness they're alive. We thank each other for taking care of ourselves, and I couldn't rely on a better bunch of guys.
Well, and I think we can all hear that in your comments, the respect you have for these Marines who you were with on a daily basis there in Korea. It's evident that you see them as collectively as a courageous group, a selfless group, a brave group. But do you have a story, maybe even more than one, that you think exemplifies or personifies that Marine spirit that you saw displayed over there?
Quite a few of them. This one friend of mine that became a friend was hit rather hard. He became what was known as a flamethrower, person. He would do anything with the Marines. Fortunately, I got to talk to some of his family. He passed away. He was wounded over there, and he was burned rather badly. And all I could do for him at that time was give him a shot of morphine and console him, get him on a stretcher, and get him back to the lines. Well, in the meantime, after the war, I met his younger brother and got to be real good friends with him over the phone and talked to him. It made the family feel better that I took care of him, did all we could, and God rest his soul, he passed away. But I'm still friends with his younger brother, and he's a very nice guy. He's got a family now, and of course the whole family missed the other gentleman, but they're super guys.
How many years later was that you met the brother?
Almost 45 years.
45 years after the war. Had you thought about this gentleman over those years?
Not really, no. But when I found out where he was and where he lived and started writing each other, it was very nice. And one of the other gentlemen that was here where I live now, who was a Marine, and I met him, and he was a forward artillery observer. And when he found out that I was a medic and I told him I was in Korea, him and I were on the very same outpost that got shelled and hit Vegas. And he was a forward artillery observer. He was one of the last guys to come off the hill.
Right, so you guys make that connection here. He introduces you to this other person whose brother died in Korea, but was a guy you tried to save. And you got to provide the family details they never had before about what happened to him?
I got details to tell his brother. I never told mom and dad. I left it up to the brother to do that. But to our identification purposes, the father had to do that, and he did recognize the person as to being his son. But it was just nice to receive congratulations or a job well done from a member of the family, and knowing that I was with that guy that day when he got hit so badly. Then I found out, of course, he died 3 days later on a hospital ship. Right there in Incheon. So I just felt kind of close to him that I got to meet his younger brother and talk to the family.
Yeah, you had the privilege of giving them something no one else could have given them, but it sounds like, too, that you look back on him and say, that was one brave Marine? Or how would you remember him?
Well, not only one brave Marine, he had never been in that position before and had never had that type of a job to do, but he did it. And so you know that when they're called to do something, they're going to do it, they're going to do the best they can, and you feel very secure in with a bunch of Marines, that's for sure. And it made me proud that I could help them as much as I could, and they appreciated it, and I appreciated them taking care of me.
Well, and that's one of more than 52,000 Americans who were killed during the Korean War. There are many missing, still missing, have never been found over there. And when you were talking about Outpost Vegas, another thing that struck me, you mentioned the Marines who got killed. You mentioned 19 more of them were captured. Did you ever consider the possibility that you might be captured, that you might become a prisoner of war?
Yes. In fact, that very day that they were captured, my friend, another corpsman, was on the outpost at that time, and he was captured. And I thought he was killed because we didn't hear anything about him. I found out many years later that he became a doctor, a pediatrician down in Florida. And so he wrote a story about the outpost when they got hit. And then I wrote my story starting with the second day after he was captured. And anyway, any of us corpsmen could have been there, could have been captured. Yeah, I thought about it because the stories that this one gentleman told in his book, they weren't too nice to any of our prisoners. I guess I can't go into anything farther, but they had some medical treatment, but it was pretty rough. And for 19 of them to get captured, and a lot of them got repatriated, and a lot of them passed away also.
Well, that's what I was getting at. And feel free to share anything. Don't hold back, but the reason I thought about you being a prisoner and what that would mean. There was no guarantee you'd survive as a prisoner. They were mistreated badly. I've talked to guys who were beaten badly by their Korean captors or Chinese captors, had very little to eat. Talked to guys who were prisoners there who were picking the digested corn out of horse excrement to try to have something to eat. I mean, can you imagine what it would have been like to be a prisoner there?
I can imagine it, but I'm sure glad I wasn't one. This one gentleman that survived came back and lived here for a while where I am, and he passed away from other things. But yes, he told stories of a lot of the guys not having any treatment, almost freezing to death, treated very badly, no food, very ill, and they actually just suffered and died. I'm glad I never got captured. I don't know what I would have done except fight to live, but I'm glad I didn't.
Well, and I know you have a fight to live, and we'll talk some more about that, but you said something there too, the freezing conditions that prisoners had to endure. Well, if you're there for almost 2 years, you had to go through those winters and the summers and probably had extremes on both ends.
Yes, I can remember one winter, the very first winter was minus 26 degrees on quite a few mornings. We had a lot of rain, a lot of snow, pretty miserable, a lot of sleet, and in the summer, pretty hot, and we had to keep the trenches clean, drained. The trenches could get as deep as they were, like 40 inches, 48 inches, and they had to try to drain them off so we could dry them out. And of course, we all lived in those hooches and stuff. They were warm, but they weren't very comfortable, but at least we had a ceiling over our head.
And as a corpsman, you're treating wounds from bullets and bombs and artillery and grenades, but you're also probably treating results of those elements. Did you have to try to help guys who had frozen fingers, frozen feet, frozen limbs?
One of my favorite things was take your socks off at night and put them under your pillow and try to dry them out. You probably heard about it. Our first couple of winters there, we had the wrong kind of boots. They were called thermal boots, but they would sweat. Your feet would sweat inside, and then they could freeze with the temperature. And, of course, they changed that rather rapidly. They got the right kind of boots, and they were well. But I always had the guys get their socks off, keep your feet dry as much as possible, and that helped out an awful lot.
What was the hardest thing for you to deal with over there, the biggest challenge you faced?
I think the biggest challenge would be keep your cool. Survive, do all the things you've learned to do, be very good friends with your fellow Marines, your fellow partners, and let them know you're there to help them, and they're there to keep you alive, which they really did a good job, because they didn't want to lose their medical technicians, and they were great fighters, and I respected everything they did, and I appreciated everything they did.
And we know that feeling was mutual, and we sure appreciate John Smetana telling us his Korean War story today. You'll find photos of John then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we're going to hear more from his colorful life when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a chance to remember what's been called the Forgotten War. the Korean War, from a man who witnessed some of the worst of it. John Smetana of Albuquerque, New Mexico, originally from Gary, Indiana, was a Navy corpsman serving with the 1st Marine Division in Korea. And John, I know you've answered some very difficult questions with us today, and maybe this one has a different twist.
You talked about what a good athlete you were before you got drafted, playing all those sports here in New Mexico. Did you still have a dream that maybe you could become a professional ball player?
Oh, for sure. There was a bunch of my buddies. We played together in the Navy before I went over, and we were up in Boston, and we played for District 3 Naval Shipyard. And we were pretty good. We got to play at Griffith Stadium in Washington and down the road there, and had a lot of fun. And we all dreamed about it. A lot of my friends that were my age, as I said, I was like 22, 23 when I was over there. And a lot of the Marine kids, I call them kids, they were like 18 and 19 years old. Well, when we got out of the service and we were 24, 25, we were kind of old for the major leagues, but we played a lot of minor league ball. But yeah, I used to dream of it all the time. I'd love to play there. I'd love to play in Kaminsky Park. Now they got a new place. But anyway, yeah, sure, I'd love to be there. Be another Satchel Paige or somebody.
There's
yeah.
always a spot for a crafty lefty.
Yeah, you're a crafty lefty. I used to throw a lot of junk. I was called a garbage pitcher. Nothing fast, but boy, that ball can dance around. Yeah.
I want to get it straight. Even there in Korea, when you're taking your socks off and putting them under your pillow and it's 20 below out there, are you sitting there dreaming about pitching in Kaminsky Park?
I'm dreaming about keeping warm. And then maybe the other also, being out there playing ball, which would be very, very, very nice. One of our great senators, Pete Domenici, he and I used to play ball together here in Albuquerque. Before he became a senator, he developed a knee problem and couldn't quite cut the mustard anymore. But he would come back while he was still living, and he'd pitch here for the Dukes a little bit, which was a lot of fun to get out and see him play. There was a lot of us, a lot of my friends who were good enough, I always thought, but age catches up with you. We were called over the hill.
Well, and the reason I brought it up was it wasn't just the age, and the Navy did take the best years of your life. The Korean War took the best years of your life, but it also took part of you. You were wounded in Korea. I'm sure that changed your baseball future. But before I hear the story about how you earned your Purple Heart, were there some other close calls that preceded that, where things came really close to getting you?
When it came close, those mortar shells and artillery were fast and furious, and you just thought, well, if you made it through, you were lucky, or God was with you. And when I got hit, I really didn't even know it until I went back to the line, to the MLR, main line of resistance, and I started feeling this burning. I had a burning sensation. Right away, I knew that I'd been hit. I could feel the different spots on my body. So I went back to the battalion aid station, and the doc dug out the steel and stuff. I was very fortunate that I didn't have any infection, didn't hit anything critical, but I had a lot of junk in my arm, leg, wrist, hand, but I got over it, thank goodness. And yeah, you think about it all the time. You know, you say, oh, the next one might have my number on it, but fortunately I made it.
Yeah. How often over the years, 65 years now since you left there, how often have you thought about the guys who didn't come home and what their sacrifice really means?
I'll tell you what, it's got to be the greatest thing in the world to give up your life for your country. But if we didn't do it, we wouldn't have what we have now. And I was very sorry. It was called a police action. And when Vietnam came, when we came home, we didn't have no parades either. We didn't have anything. They didn't even know we were gone, I don't think, other than our loved ones. And then for Vietnam, they didn't have any parades either. And I think patriotically, that was bad, very bad. And a lot of people didn't really know what we went through over there.
So if one of your grandkids comes to you now, and you've got a few of them, you have 5 kids, 9 grandkids, and 2 great-grandkids. If one of them comes to you and says, Grandpa, what was the Korean War all about? Why were you guys over there, and why should we care now? How do you answer that question?
That's exactly right. And I tell them, I said, well, we were over to keep our democracy clean, help people out that needed help, not to be overrun by communism or a different government than what we had. And Most of them were going to school, and they understood what was going on over there. I left them with high hopes to always be truthful, sincere, love your country, love your buddies, and take care of mom and dad.
Great lessons we can all learn there. You came home from Korea, and it sounds like the wounds didn't bother you that much. You got over that pretty quickly?
Yeah, I got over that pretty fast. I had a couple there where I needed a stitch or two in my hip, but that didn't bother me. I got those out in about 5 or 6 days, and nothing bothered me after I came home other than the thoughts about being there. And it's kind of crazy to be there. I think everybody else felt that way too. Mentioned before, I met a friend of mine that lives here now. He was in the Army as an Army engineer, and we actually came home on the same troop ship, General Collins. We started laughing about it because there's like 3,500 of us coming home all together, Marines, Army, and whatever else was on there. And that was pretty funny.
Yeah, it's a small world. Well, and that was my next question. I asked about the physical impact, but was there a lasting mental impact of this? Did you experience flashbacks or have a hard time adjusting to civilian life after spending 2 years out there on the front lines?
The worst thing I thought was, why are we over there? Why are we there? And you're talking, feel like 50,000 people getting killed. That's quite a number of people. That's like a medium-sized city. And we all at different times thought it was kind of foolish. We didn't want it to happen, but it did. And other than that, we're back. We're going to make the best of it and try to make ourselves stronger.
Had you met your wife before the war or after you came home?
Actually, right before I left, I met her and went together for a while. I told her to go out and have a good time. I'll be back. And if we still felt the same way, we'd get married. And we did. She had our first 5 children. She had some medical problems, and she passed away. And I couldn't stand being alone, so I got remarried and was very happy about that. But, yeah, she waited for me, and thank goodness. We had a wonderful life.
And I know you spent 32 years here in New Mexico with Sandia National Laboratories, but you also found a way to stay involved in sports. And we've been getting along pretty well here, but, you know, my day job is I'm a sports announcer, and we're kind of known for not always saying the nicest things about officials. And you've been an official in baseball and basketball and football. I bet you never made a bad call, though, right?
Well, he often asked me where I left my dog or where my cane was. But where's your dog, ref? Or too bad you're missing a good game. Yeah, I started out with little kids like 9, 10 years old, and I worked my way up to college. And I was fortunate to work in the conference, a couple of conferences. I love kind of basketball, I guess. Baseball, I didn't want to take the brutality of an umpire. But I think I could. But, yeah, I had a lot of good friends, amazingly, as being an official, and a lot of good buddies, a lot of good guys. And it seems like if you're thinking right and you got the good friends on your side, the fans will come around. They'll come around, and you do the best job you can, and you'll never forget any calls that you made. And you made them because you knew they were right, and you just kind of tune yourself out to the crowd. That's all you could do.
Is there a particular game or situation that stands out that you reflect back on a lot? Maybe it was a big game, maybe a controversial game, but one that you found yourself stuck right in the middle of and everybody waiting to see what you thought happened?
Not so much what everybody else thought. I was an umpire, and in football, you're right behind the defensive line. I've been run over a few times, and you don't have much protection. At least they got all those pads on. You do the best job you can and hope you call it right. Let the ref know everything you saw and let him make his decision. It was very enjoyable, very enjoyable.
Now, I always say, and especially today because the rules have changed, I say basketball is by far the toughest sport to officiate because it's so subjective and you could call something every time down the floor, but you can't. It ruins the game. What did you find was the toughest thing of being an official?
Being sure what you called. Make sure you see what you see and always be consistent. Don't be haphazard. Be consistent. That's all a coach wants. If you're going to call it that way all night. Don't change in the middle of the game because then they don't know what to expect, and neither do the players. And now at the Final Four, I just watched the other night, those guys did an excellent job. And like Paul said, rules have changed. It's how much you're going to call, how much you're going to let them play, how rough are they going to be, and it's so quick, so fast. Your decisions are so fast, and you never change. Just be yourself, do the best job you can, and be consistent. That's all anybody asks. Let them know that you're going to call it that way, and they'll play that way.
Well, and anything else that you think is relevant, I want to touch on here, John, but there's one thing I want to talk to you about, because I'm sure when you meet people here in Albuquerque, maybe even here at Paloma Landing when a new resident comes in, they might find out you're a Korean War veteran and a Purple Heart recipient, and then they see that you're missing both legs below the knees, and they probably think that happened in the war. But you've been living this way for 18 years because of peripheral arterial disease. But I see such enthusiasm in you. It doesn't seem like this is slowing you down too much or weighing you down. How's that possible?
I've always been up. In fact, people here, amazing, they say, you're amazing that you can have such an outlook on life. I said, don't let yourself crawl in a hole. You got to smile, accept everything you have, be friendly, smile, be a good guy, a good person, help other people out, make them feel good. When you feel good, they'll feel good. I have people come up and say, you always have a smile. I said, yeah, why should I want to frown? I love people. I love to see them up and be happy. And as you get older, you want to keep your spirits up. You don't want to dig a hole or anything like that. Just be yourself, be happy, and love everything every day.
And where does that come from? What is the source of that joy and enthusiasm and hope that you're exuding here?
Fortunately, it comes from my dad. He was a laundry foreman for drivers. And in Gary, Indiana, when I was like 10 or 11 years old, he used to have one route that he liked to go on were to the hotels in Gary. We would always whistle. My dad used to whistle all kinds of tunes, and I did too. And the ladies that were doing the housework in the hotel said, oh, here comes John, here comes John, with little John. And we'd be smiling, and my dad would smile, and we'd whistle. They're the happiest guys in the world. That started way back when I was a kid, 10, 11 years old. I can still remember it. And I've never faltered. I've never changed. And I never will.
There's a photo here behind you where I think that is on display, because you've got about the happiest look somebody could have on your face. And you also have a couple headphones on and a little leather helmet there. You got to go up in a Stearman with Ageless Aviation Dreams. And from what I understand, that was no small feat for them to get you in that 1920s cockpit of that biplane.
That's a good question, Paul. Yes, it took 7 firemen to put me in the airplane, which was wonderful. And it took 9 to get me out. And that was pretty funny. And on that airplane, you had to step at a certain place. Well, I couldn't do it because of my amputee, so they lifted me up and put me in, lifted me up and took me out. But boy, was that fun. I'll never forget it. It was a great experience. And yeah, they were wonderful.
Did they let you handle the controls at all up there?
Thank goodness, no. As we were landing, the wind was coming up. We were coming in, and I looked at the runway, and actually, you've heard of the term fishtail. Well, that's what we did. We came in at about 85, maybe a 90-degree angle almost to the ground. And just before we hit, he straightened it out and set it down. The guy did a fabulous job because I was a little bit scared at that time.
Well, and we've talked about Ageless Aviation Dreams a couple times on this program. They're out of Oregon, but they go all over the country providing this experience. What did that mean to you, that people would take their own plane, their own money, come to give you, as a veteran, a chance to get up and have that thrill ride?
They were fantastic. And all the guys here that got to go up, it was wonderful. One of the fellows that went up was an ex-pilot. He flew B-36s, and he knew how to fly. So this gentleman that took us up let him take the controls, and he felt wonderful. So he got to do a few, not big figure eights, but the slow roll and stuff, and he was out of his mind. It was wonderful. He had more fun than you could ever believe, and so did I. And it was very, very great for them to do that.
Well, I know one thing I haven't said to you yet, John, is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for giving us a taste of what a corpsman went through during the Korean War. I know none of us are dying to trade places with you after hearing what you went through over there. Another thing I've got to ask you, just visiting you and in your place here, I see a lot of crosses on the wall. I even see St. Francis over there, and a lot of things that are indicative of the faith you clearly have. What role has that played in your life story? And is there a spot where you say, you know, God was intervening on my behalf?
You're very right, Paul. I'm Catholic, and every Thursday here we have a service of pre-communion, and we have communion, and I do the first reading, and there you go again. I'm the happy guy, and I have a very soft voice, and I don't need a microphone. But the crosses are just a remembrance of when our Lord died, and my kids, my girls mostly, make these crosses. And my granddaughter made the one right behind you, and she was about 9 years old when she put that together. I was very proud. And all the rest are from members of the family. St. Francis, he's a good guy. I have quite a few little angels on the wall, and yes, God was on my side, and I was very happy for that. I said a lot of prayers to him, and he took care of me, and I'm very fortunate that he did.
Well, and I can tell that you look back on a lot of things that you're thankful for, but what about looking forward? Is there anything that you haven't done yet that you're hoping to do someday?
Just watch the grandkids grow up, go to all the weddings, stay healthy, be a good guy every day. I'm also known as an ambassador here at Paloma Landing, where I get to meet the new people, have lunch with them or breakfast or whatever, and tell them about stuff and how nice it is here. And I'm very fortunate that I live here. It's very safe, very warm, good people, and I want to try to keep everybody happy.
Anything else I didn't ask you about that you want people to know?
I wish I could get out and do the 100-yard dash, but I can't do it. But that doesn't stop me. I have a motorized cart, and I'm very careful. And I hope, as I slow down, I don't want to slow down too fast. I'll keep going every day and make every day a good day. And I'll never forget my days there serving with the other guys. I'm sorry for the families that lost loved ones, but that's the way war is, and I hope we don't have any more, and I'm just going to be thankful that I'm here, that I'm alive, and I love everybody.
That's John Smetana, 87 years old, with a resilient spirit we all would do well to emulate. That's our program for today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time on Hometown Heroes when we catch up with one of the last survivors of yet another ship that has just been discovered at the bottom of the ocean 75 years after it was sunk. Make sure to thank the veterans in your life today and let their faces, their voices, their memories be a reminder to all of us that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.